Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. As many WGTD listeners probably know, in my other life away from the radio station, I am a teacher. I am a music professor at Carthage College. And what some of you may not know, although it certainly has been mentioned from time to time on the morning show, I am married to a teacher. I am married to a public school educator, an elementary school music teacher. And so teaching is something that is very important to me, of great interest on all kinds of different levels. And whenever a book crosses my path that is exceptionally interesting and potentially even transformative for someone who wants to be the very best teacher they can be, it's a book I am eager to share with listeners and talk about. And such a book is before us today, a book called I Wish My Teacher Knew: How One Question Can Change Everything for Our Kids. And the author of this book is Kyle Schwartz, and she is a third-grade teacher living in Denver, Colorado. And in this book, she talks about a moment relatively early in her teaching career when she actually invited some of the young students in her elementary school class to write out on a little piece of paper something which they suspected their teacher did not know about them, but which they wished they knew. And it was an extraordinarily powerful and helpful exercise. And although she, in a sense, kind of kept it to herself for a while, this was eventually an exercise which she shared with some colleagues. And it's one of those things that, in a sense, went viral. And all kinds of other teachers made use of this very simple exercise. Well, this book is about a lot more than that, although she talks about the importance of that, but goes on from there to talk about all kinds of other ways in which a teacher can make an enormous and really, in a sense, irreplaceable difference in the lives of their students, and particularly those students who, from the moment they walk into the classroom, might be bearing particular burdens or working from some sort of disadvantage with no fault of their own. And it is an inspiring book that I hope many, many teachers will take in hand. It's published by Da Capo. Again, it's called I Wish My Teacher Knew: How One Question Can Change Everything for Our Kids. Kyle Schwartz, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm very, very excited about this. One thing that comes as a bit of a shock in the book is when you talk about how much you hated school as a student. And I don't know how many teachers there are out there who say that, maybe more than I would suspect, but I think a whole lot of teachers themselves loved school, were successful students in every respect. You are not that kind of typical student. Tell our listeners about that.
Yeah, I really, the chances of me growing up to be an elementary school teacher were very slim, because as a child, an elementary school teacher was like my arch nemesis. And I kind of tell my story in the book where my family moved from a small town in rural Illinois, and we moved into like the suburb to end all suburbs in Denver. And it was a massive culture shock for me. But of course, you know, at the time, I wasn't really aware of, you know, what a culture shock was or why things were different. And I made a very practical decision, and I can really remember, like, really thinking these thoughts in my head, like, I don't like these people. Like, I don't need these people. I don't need to be friends with these people. I don't trust these people. And so I kind of, like, shut down. I put up a massive barrier. I became, like, a very difficult child to have in a classroom. I had a really difficult time connecting and making relationships with teachers, certainly, and also with students. And so I think now that I am a teacher, I bring a very different perspective to the classroom. And I am very open with my students about it, about my experience in school. And, I think for one thing for me is just those kids that are, maybe challenging to have in a classroom or may cause frustration, I have a big heart for them. And it's something I really try to share for in the book.
Right. And I think there are some ways in which we get a sense that you are the kind of teacher you are and that you enjoy the success that you do with certain difficult or challenging students, if we want to call them that, because of your own background. For instance, you say at one point, while I had lovely teachers, none appreciated my inability to navigate this cultural shift that you were experiencing in that move that was made by your family. Looking back, I am surprised at the strategies I deployed to cope with this situation in such pragmatic and ultimately destructive ways. And of course, that is something that is not always evident, maybe seldom evident just at a glance, in terms of a student's behavior that might in fact be masking or shielding something really difficult for them just beneath the surface.
I think that, especially for students, taking on the affect of I don't care is a really safe affect, because if you don't care what the teacher thinks or you don't care what the other students think, it's harder to get hurt. But I think we see that a lot with students who have maybe been through something difficult. I mean, certainly something more difficult than just moving into a different environment. But we see that in students where they take on this attitude of, I don't care, and it's just self-protective. But as teachers, sometimes we see that as oh, well, they don't care, why should I care? Or, they're not putting the effort in, or I'm working so hard to reach the student and they're not reaching back. And I think it really just... it just takes some time to think, what else is going on with this student? A student, not wanting to learn or not caring or not making connections with other children, that's not a natural state of a child. So there has to be something that has caused that, that difficult attitude or that, maybe some aggressive behavior, some inability to pay attention. And so as a teacher, maybe just adopting that attitude of curiosity before, labeling or making a conclusion about a student.
Right.
And that's something I really tried to do with the I Wish My Teacher Knew notes, was instead of making assumptions about my students, to really ask them, what do I need to know? And I was so pleasantly surprised that they were willing to be so brave and answer back to me and really tell me what I needed to know as a teacher.
Right. And I have to say that although your book, I think, is very much, of course, written from your own perspective and I think is most directly helpful to other teachers in your specific field, I have to say that even as a college professor teaching spending most of the teaching day teaching private voice lessons one-on-one. I mean, a very, very different situation, and in many ways not nearly so challenging as standing in front of a group of 28 elementary kids and trying to make sense of all that and teaching effectively to all of them. I mean, I can't imagine how difficult that is. But even for me, I have found a lot to think about, and one of them is I realize how simple it is to jump to quick conclusions about a given student, that student X is lazy, or student X doesn't care, or student X doesn't like me, or whatever it might be, and that there is something very tempting about sort of jumping to those simple, clean labels about a student and then teaching them accordingly from that point on. What a terrible mistake that is for a teacher to make, and what a disservice it does to that student.
And I think it's something that people struggle with even beyond teachers, is kind of, taking a quick and efficient approach and just, labeling someone or jumping to a conclusion. But I'm really hopeful that some information in the book and some other conversations that are happening in teaching can kind of open people's eyes. There's one chapter in the book specifically around grief and loss. And that chapter is, you know, one of my favorite things that I was able to put in the book, because I think a lot of times we are very quick to label, especially with the words lazy or and disrespectful, some symptoms of grief and loss. So when we look at actual symptoms of grief and loss, like noisy outbursts, aggressive behavior, isolation and withdrawal, noncompliance, those all are symptoms of grief, documented symptoms of grief, but don't they sound a lot like things that we, quote, discipline kids for in school? And so a lot of the times we're addressing a symptom like an inability to pay attention or an aggressive behavior. We're addressing that symptom, but we're never getting to the underlying cause, which in some cases may be grief, in some cases may be trauma. And I really believe that it is our school's jobs to address those situations, because kids will only learn in environments where they feel safe. We will, humans only learn in environments where they feel valued and where there's a relationship there. So if there's a block to a relationship or a block to a student feeling safe, we have to address that as schools and teachers.
Before we dig into some specifics in your book, I would really like to know a little bit more about how you made this leap that just is a little bit surprising, maybe even bewildering, to go from being a student who really disliked school so much and struggled to succeed, becoming a successful teacher. I mean, at what point did it become clear to you that this should be your life's path? I mean, and what did it feel like for you to, in a sense, make a leap like that?
Well, for me, it was really, the life-changing experience for me was being an AmeriCorps member in Washington, D.C. I was with an organization called City Year, which is education-focused, and it was during college. I took a year off college, and I was really enthusiastic about doing this year of national service and ended up working in D.C. public schools. What I saw in D.C. public schools, which at the time were ranked like some of the worst schools in the nation, was so shocking to me. Like I said, I grew up in a suburb. We had extremely well-resourced schools. Like, our school was like fundraising for like trips to Disney World for the football players. So we didn't have like acute needs for like hard resources. And when I went into DC public schools, I was so shocked. I had been very sheltered, as many people are, about the inequities in our public school system, and it really angered me. It like lit that fire in me that the kids that I was interacting with were so brilliant, were so smart, and yet they often did not have very basic things. There were gunshot holes in the door in the way to the school, and kids were walking through that every day. There were broken windows in the school that you could stick your hand through. And while there were some really dedicated teachers in the school, the kids were just drowning in the system that had been failing them. And so for me as a teacher, I teach because I do like, giving kids new academic concepts and helping them with their critical thinking skills. But I also teach as an act of social justice, because our education system is very, very broken for many, many children. And I do not want to live in an America where we've got students who love to learn and love school and families who value education, and yet they're not met with a school that's going to help them reach their potential. And so that's really what impacted me to teach. And I'm just so glad I do. I tell people I have my dream job, and I highly recommend it to everybody else to get their dream job.
You, part of your pathway towards becoming a teacher, becoming certified, was to be part of something called the Denver Teacher Residency Program. And you don't tell us a whole lot about it, but you tell us enough so we are, our curiosity is certainly piqued, because this is not a completely conventional program for training teachers. Tell us a little bit about this program and what kind of a difference you think it made.
Yeah, so there's a lot of different ways and pathways into the classroom now. And one of the ways which I'm most excited about was the way that I got into the classroom, which was through a teacher residency. And so a teacher residency basically acknowledges, which I think is very important, that teaching is a professional practice. And it takes the model from healthcare that is, you know, really in-depth study of teaching in a real-life situations with highly skilled help and support. So when I was going into the classroom, I was not only taking classes and earning a master's degree in teaching and learning like some sound pedagogical practices, but I was applying them every day in a real classroom. And here's the little trick. Under the tutelage of a master teacher, and her name is Rachel Bernard, and she is a fantastic teacher, and I got to be in her classroom for an entire school year just soaking up, like, her mastery of teaching, and then also, you know, trying to do a lesson, getting her feedback, doing it again, trying maybe a day's worth of lessons, getting her feedback, planning things out with her support, and It was in the same neighborhood in which I would eventually teach. So I was learning to work with the same population in which I would teach independently the following year. And it's a style of teacher preparation which I am very, very enthusiastic about and a huge advocate for. And I think that a teaching residency is something that we can expand in teacher preparation. It's something we can do, and I think it's something we should do for students.
We're speaking with Kyle Schwartz, who is the author of a marvelous book called I Wish My Teacher Knew, How One Question Can Change Everything for Our Kids. This title springs at least most directly from an experiment which I mentioned in the introduction to our interview, where Kyle Schwartz gave her students in her classroom an opportunity to, complete this sentence. I wish my teacher knew, ... whatever that might be. I wonder if we could just talk about that experiment for a moment. First of all, did it echo anything that you had ever yourself experienced, either in your own schooling? I'm pretty sure the answer to that is no, because you talk about how you never really experienced that level of connection with any of your teachers, but in any of your training? Or was this, in a sense, one of those sort of great ideas that was largely kind of out of the blue? And to some extent, maybe a sort of a chance or a risk that you were taking?
I can't really pin down the exact origins of the idea. I think I got I kind of got the idea in classes that I was taking as a teacher, but it really just kind of, you know, came up one day in my classroom. I was like, you know what, let me just give them this opportunity. And that first year, I just passed out notes and just put on the board, I wish my teacher knew, and then they wrote in their answer. And then I collected them and read them privately. But I think kind of to what you're speaking about is that, yes, many things that the students were saying were very different from my own personal experience, particularly students, you know, telling me how much it affects them that a parent is not able to be present for them, or, you know, a lack of having, you know, hard resources, such as a student saying, I wish my teacher knew I don't have pencils at home to do my homework. But then there were also, like, everyday universal struggles of childhood. A student, you know, saying, I wish my teacher knew I don't have a friend to play with me. Or, you know, I had another student who, you know, actually read his to the class, and he said, I wish my teacher knew I don't think people like me in this classroom. And so that, you know, those kind of universal things that kind of supersede economic and racial divides that I do have with my students, I think are really important to know as well, and really important to address for students in order to serve them better.
Hmm. Your book goes on far beyond that experiment to talk about all kinds of different matters that relate to a teacher and their relationship with their students, and also the relationship between the students in a given classroom. And in the first chapter of the book, you talk about this notion of community and each class being a community. And in trying to help us understand the significance of this, you tell us about a young student whom you call Ronaldo. I don't know if that's his real name or not, but certainly the story of this student is completely real and very, very powerful. Please share that story with our listeners.
So Ronaldo was a wonderful student in my classroom, and you're right, that is not his real name. But he dealt with something that many, many of my students deal with, and he dealt with the deportation of his father. And, you know, I don't know all of the details about how that came about, but I do know how Ronaldo dealt with it, which was very moving for me to see as a teacher. Because, so basically, the family found out that the father had lost the legal case and was indeed going to be deported to Mexico. And Ronaldo, in how I would have dealt with that, would have been like very much acting out or shutting down. But for Ronaldo, he came to school every day with these thank you notes for teachers. And he gave them to his old teachers, he gave them to the school secretaries, he gave them to me, and they, you know, all said something like, dear Miss Swartz, thank you for all that you've done for me. I love this school. I love learning here. Thank you for helping me learn. And I will always remember you, so do not forget me. Do you promise not to forget me? And he was, you know, passing these notes out, and, you know, even though he knew he was going to have to go to Mexico, a country which he was not at all familiar with, he still every day did his homework. He actually did extra homework up until the very last day that he left. He helped all other students. And he was just, he really dealt with this horrific and I think very unfair situation with so much grace. And for me, it was really moving to see. But it was also something I needed to address in my classroom, because while Ronaldo was dealing with this issue, it kind of also had ripple effects, because the fear of deportation is very real in the school community that I'm in. And so when he was forced to leave, that really scared and provoked a lot of fear and trepidation in my other students. And so we kind of went through this process where, you know, we said goodbye to him, and we, you know, wished him good luck, and a few other things that I mentioned in the book, some tools that teachers can use. Like, we gave him a shark tooth necklace so that he could be strong like a shark when he leaves, and we wrote him letters. And so we did all these activities that were really healing for the class. Because, you know, him leaving, I'm sure, was really difficult for him, and we wanted to support him, but there were also the rest of the class that we needed to support as well.
You go on to really discuss this matter of student mobility, and it's an innocuous term on the surface. I mean, it doesn't seem like anything that should cause anyone, teachers or students, undue concern or alarm. And yet beneath that innocuous-sounding term is a reality that can be tremendously painful for a given student and their classmates and their teacher. And you tell us that our students are increasingly mobile. And so this is not a problem or a challenge that's going away. If anything, it is a challenge that is deepening and becoming more and more complex. What's going on here? Why is this becoming a more and more pervasive element in public school classrooms across the country?
Well, there are many factors that are contributing to the high rates of student mobility. And certainly, you know, I think economic factors are a huge one. Housing insecurity, a transitioning economy, jobs moving away. These are all things that are really going to affect a student's ability to stay in one place and learn. And we have very strong evidence to suggest that a student staying in the same place and learning in the same school has better has better academic outcomes for the student. So each time a student moves, there is, you know, a consequence to that move. And particularly when we have highly mobile students, which is a term used to describe students who make many transitions between schools, more than four, they're very impacted in their learning, because each time you move schools, you know, you're adjusting to perhaps a new curriculum, a new teacher, a new environment, and there's social implications. But there's also very real academic challenges to moving school to school. But one thing I really talked about in the book was the difference between a voluntary move and an involuntary move. And so a voluntary move is when, you know, a family is making a choice to move schools for one reason or another. It could be great, like there's a new job and they're moving to be closer to it, or it could be to move to, you know, what they perceive as a better school. But these involuntary moves typically happen in the middle of the year. So they're not really a choice that a family is making. It's you know, a forced choice. So maybe, you know, there was an eviction, or they have to move in with a family member to you know, have a home to live in. And so those involuntary moves are particularly difficult for students. And I think that as teachers, you know, as myself as a teacher who has a very mobile population, we do get new students in the middle of the year. And it's difficult for them to address academically, but also there is almost always some underlying issue that needs to be addressed. So, you know, perhaps a student has just moved back to the United States from another country and they're moving in the middle of the year. Or, you know, in some cases, like another school has pushed the student out and so they're coming to our school. And so it's, you know, it's a real issue that teachers need to address and that we need to start talking about as, you know, as a community that says, like, can we create some policies that would alleviate the student mobility? If we know it's impacting kids' learning, what can we do to alleviate it? Because I think people think often when kids move, they're moving, like, cities or they're moving states. But really what we found is that when kids are moving, they're moving blocks. They're moving from one apartment complex to another. And because we've drawn boundaries in a certain way, that means they have to move schools. And so I think that there's some things on a policy level that we can do to help alleviate the harm that student mobility is causing. But I also talk about real ways in classrooms that teachers can alleviate student mobility.
And I want to say, I think you've made passing reference to this, but we should really drive home this point, that not only in this book do you talk about all of this in kind of philosophical terms or conceptual terms, but then you always follow up with what you call teacher tools, with very, very practical suggestions about what a teacher can do about the challenge that you have just laid out. And we certainly won't have time to talk about each and every tool in each and every chapter, but I would love to take a couple minutes to talk about the tools that you spell out in this particular chapter called Welcomes and Farewells, where you suggest some ways in which a teacher can make a huge difference in the way that a student can feel so much more comfortable and confident in a brand new school and in a brand new classroom. Would you mind talking us through a couple of the more significant ones?
Absolutely. So these teacher tools that I wanted to include, I intentionally made them very actionable. So things that a teacher could actually do in their classroom. You know, I'm a real live human teacher, and there are some things that I would love to do, but maybe aren't actually practical for me to do in my classroom. So I really focused on the things that I found success with that are very doable for teachers. And one of them I call welcome kits. And it's this very simple idea of knowing that you are going to have new students in your classroom at some point during the middle of the year, and you probably won't have very much warning about it. So have things ready for a student before they even get there. And I do that just at the beginning of the year when I'm setting up my classroom. I already, like, put, like, five piles aside of, like, all the, you know, paperwork that they'll need, you know, welcome letters that I'm passing out to all students. I'll just kind of group together for a potential new student to have. But then I'll also include, like, things like school supplies so that I know when a new student comes, I'm already logistically prepared for it. Because I've had experiences before, and I talk about it in the book, where typically what happens to a teacher in a school like mine is there's, like, a phone call that morning that says, like, hey, by the way, you have a new student. Her name's this. And so I had a new student my first year, and I was also told that she used a wheelchair. And so I was like a mess running around trying to like rearrange my classroom so, you know, she could have access to everything. And by the time she got there, I was like frazzled, nothing was ready. And here comes a new student who's, you know, trepidation into entering a new classroom is much bigger than my worry that things aren't ready. And if we have things ready for students just logistically, we can start with the relationship, which is another tool that I talk about in the book, is that when a new student comes into your classroom, you know, your first goal is to start with building a relationship with that student. And that starts with saying, like, I'm glad you're here, like explicitly stating that probably several times. Like, I'm glad you're here. This is a good place to be, and you can help us. And I think that little trick at the end is a real great way to get students like involved in the community. And even if it's something as small as like, hey, I'm so glad you're here because we need somebody to stack the chairs at the end of the day. Can you help us with that? And they already feel like they're contributing to the community. Or, you know, like, hey, I'm so glad you're here. Like, we actually, and it looks like you really like, you know, football, and we need somebody who can write about football, you know.
Right, so, or you're tall enough to reach this top shelf.
Yes.
And I'm not tall enough or whatever it might be. And, you know, and one of my favorite suggestions you make is when you say, when a student comes, the next thing you should say is, sit here. And of course, it's so tempting for somebody to say, okay, go find a seat someplace. And you spell out how that can be an absolutely terrifying thing for a new student to do who doesn't know who sits where and, you know, what sort of indiscretion they might be committing without realizing it by choosing someone else's chair. So you say where they sit. I mean, what a simple yet important suggestion.
It's just that empathy that you'd have. Like, think about what it's like to be a new student in that moment, and like, how can you support them?
Right. And of course, when you think about it, the typical teacher, first of all, hasn't themselves had really that exact experience in decades. It's maybe been 50 years since a given teacher has been in those precise shoes. And so I'm so glad that you take a moment to talk about that. We're talking with Kyle Schwartz about her book, I Wish My Teacher Knew, How One Question Can Change Everything for Our Kids. And in the second chapter of the book, you talk about something that is a brutal, tragic reality for so many students. In fact, for over half of our students across the country, we are talking about students living in poverty. I mean, it's just shocking to think about this, and I know it is something that bothers you to the core of your being. You explore the ramifications of this on all kinds of different levels. I want to give you a chance to talk about something that you actually talked about a little more than I sort of expected you to, and that has to do with the National School Lunch Program and some of the specifics about it and some of the specifics about eligibility requirements and so on. You clearly care about this issue a lot, and you think teachers need to care about it a lot and work proactively on this issue. Just say a word about why it is so important.
Teachers love their acronyms, and one acronym that teachers use a lot is FRL, which means free and reduced lunch. And we use this term a lot because it is a marker of poverty. Students who live at or very near to the federal poverty line qualify for free lunch. And so when we're talking about students or, you know, the nature of a school, often we refer to the free lunch rate, which means how many students in your school are experiencing poverty. And so my school's free and reduced lunch rate is 90%. Which is huge, but also very common. Almost a quarter of students go to school in high concentration of poverty schools, which means that there's more than 75% of kids who are living at or very near to the poverty line. But I think one thing that maybe teachers don't always pay attention to is even though we talk about this free and reduced lunch rate, often we don't really know about this policy. And I think it's really important for teachers to know about it because it's really affecting our students. Because really, and I talk about in the book, as things stand right now, there are very few places in the country where you can earn the minimum wage and your child will not qualify for free and reduced lunch. So we have in our school, we see very real effects of living in or very close to poverty every single day. And I think that we really need to understand, you know, have a good concept of exactly how many students is this affecting? Is it just our school community and the forces that are impacting that? But I really want people to know the statistic that in America today, we literally have more children living at or very near the poverty line than we have that are not. So it is a massive issue. It is an issue that schools are addressing, but it's also an issue that schools need to understand the policy and forces behind.
Right. I love a moment in this chapter as you are spelling out some of your tools when you talk about something that you always have in your desk or somewhere in your classroom, the food drawer. And it's really important that we understand exactly how you sort of do this, because the way you do it and the dignity which you allow the students to have really plays an important part in how successful this is and what a difference it makes. Explain how the food drawer works in Kyle Schwartz's classroom.
So it's not really this radical concept, but it is, you know, something that really works well in my classroom. It's literally just a drawer of food. So I have an actual drawer in my classroom that has like granola bars or graham crackers or like leftover snacks. And it's available for all students whenever they need it. And it's something that I really kind of changed my idea behind, because in my first year of teaching, I could notice that kids were coming in hungry. They were coming in like tired, irritable. And, you know, just like we were talking about before, to dig in deeper, like why is this happening? And oftentimes it was because students were hungry because they didn't really have, you know, access to food at home. And so I would just, you know, pass out granola bars, like, hey, here's a granola bar. And one student, like, threw it back at me, and he was like, I don't need this. And I could tell in that moment, like, he was hungry, but by me publicly passing it out to him, I had announced it to the whole class. And so I just, you know, made a, you know, quick course correction, and I just said, all right, guys, you know, here's the deal. There's always going to be food in this drawer. If you need it, take it. There's no rules. You can take it if you need it. And what happens is, I think maybe some people will think like, oh, kids will abuse that. That does not happen. Kids that need that food remember it and know it's there. And kids who don't need it don't even notice it. And so I don't really see kids taking it, but I know that it's helping students because, you know, every couple of weeks it's empty and I need to refill it.
Right. And you know, you're so right to say that you're certainly by no means the only teacher who does this kind of thing in their classroom in one way or another. And, of course, that's one of the most gratifying things and that needs to be said again and again, is that there are all kinds of teachers who care about their students and who do all kinds of things above and beyond the call of duty and the word of the job description to try to make a positive impact on especially some of these students who have these really significant disadvantages. And but the fact that you do this the way you do, I think, will be really helpful to, you know, maybe a young student who might be motivated to do something like this, but who might not realize how important it is to do it right. So I do appreciate how you lay that out. In the third chapter, you talk about the complexity of the modern family, in a sense, that once upon a time, you every so often would come across a family in which there was divorce or something else that made it not quite the standard Leave It to Beaver family. And now we find more Brady Bunch families and Modern Family families more and more. And you clearly believe that it is really important that teachers are mindful and sensitive to the families of their students, however complicated those families may be. Just say a word about why this is so significant.
Well, I think kind of to your point, it's far beyond just I encounter it occasionally. Literally more than half of students do not go home to a married mother and father. So in our schools, if we're saying like, oh, have your parents sign this or tell your mom and dad that we have a field trip, like that's not actually an accurate statement for many of our kids. And especially kids who experience poverty have, non-traditional families, although we know that, you know, the traditional family never really has been the majority in America. But just to be aware that, like, our students' family makeup is changing and that our schools really need to respond to it. And I think the most important salient point here is it's not about, like, allowing non-traditional families to participate the way traditional families would. It's not about like making an exception to a rule. It's about completely changing the rule altogether and making a universal system where like all families can come in regardless. So one thing that I've done in my classroom is I don't say parents. I don't say like, oh, have your parents come or tell your parents. You know, I really try to intentionally say like, invite your families. All your families and friends are welcome to this. And I think those words really matter. I think that, just a small change, like we have a parent-teacher conference, right? We have that all the time. And often I am the teacher meeting with the parent. But many times I'm meeting with an aunt or an uncle or another caretaker, a grandmother. And so I think it's important. It's a small and important step to be really intentional about the language we use around families. But it's also like these everyday things that we do in our classrooms that we might not think about, like doing a family tree project or, like bringing a picture of your family. I think these little things in our classroom, if we're going to have real stringent definitions of family, that can be harmful to kids. So one thing I talk about, instead of if you really need to do a family tree project, like maybe change it to like a family constellation or a family wheel, you know, have it so all students can participate and that all families can participate and be welcome. And I think it's a shift that schools really need to make intentionally to
Absolutely.
Serve all of the families.
Explain what the CQC time is in your family. I love in your classroom. Hey, that's an interesting slip of the tongue. I just called it in your family. You try to make your classroom sort of a family, and CQC time has to do with family. Explain what this is about.
Well, you know, it's another one of those ideas that's not really rocket science but has been really successful. It actually came out of our staff meetings at our school where, you know, our principal would say, does anyone have a celebration, a question, or concern? And I think just calling out all three of those for students, and so we have that every day. So does anyone have a celebration, question, or concern, like a CQC? Does anyone have any of those? Just denotes for students, like, you're allowed to tell cool things about your life. You're allowed to brag about your life. You're also allowed to tell us, like, something that's worrying you. You're also allowed to tell us something that's not great that you need support with. And you can ask questions. Your curiosity is welcome here. So I think just doing that is really helpful for students and inviting them to share with the class all the facets of their life. So I'll have kids that come in and they're like, Miss, I've got a celebration today. Like, I've got to tell everyone this. But I also have kids that, like, literally come straight up to me and say, like, when are we going to do CQC because I have a concern to share?
Mm.
Like, my grandmother is in the hospital and I need to share this. So it's about giving that outlet for students, giving them permission and giving them the invitation to share things that are really important for our classroom community to know.
I love that. There are two more things I want to touch on, and I need to make sure that our listeners know that there is a ton of stuff in this book, even though it's not a gigantic book, but it's packed with wonderful and interesting information. So we are just scratching the surface. In the chapter where you talk about the grief that sometimes students experience, your first teacher tool is tell the truth. And one of the reasons I want to take just a minute or two to talk about this is because this is something that is so meaningful, even if you're not a teacher. This is still a truth that is really important for anybody. If you're just a friend or a neighbor, it has to do with difficult questions and honest answers and the kind of promises that one can make. And that has to do with also when you have a student who's maybe experiencing some kind of trauma or even abuse. Just talk about the transcendent importance of honesty.
Well, I wish I knew where I heard this phrase, but I guess the question is, like, is a child, like, when is it ready to talk about a difficult topic with a child? And, you know, this phrase of when a child is able to ask an intelligible question, they deserve an intelligible answer. And so, you know, oftentimes, especially things like grief and trauma are difficult and intimidating subjects for teachers to approach. It's very necessary. And I talk about one time that a girl just like in the middle of class, like shot up her hand and was like, I need to know if cancer can kill you. And I want to know if my grandma's going to die. And, you know, as a teacher, you're kind of like, oh, okay, guess we're going to pause fractions for a second and talk about this. But, you know, like she deserved an answer to that. That was a genuine worry that she had. And to just be like honest, like, you know, it usually depends on what type of cancer a person has and how well medicine can help them. And I don't know about your grandma, but maybe we can ask someone. And so I think that it's just these like simple answers that kids really deserve. Like, you know, is this tragedy my fault? You know, and to be able to answer that, like, simply and honestly for a kid, like, no, it's not your fault. Oftentimes kids in your situation feel bad about it, but it's not your fault. And so I think it's just that, like, honest answers that teachers can do for their kids, even in intimidating topics, we can do it. And if you just have those answers in your back pocket, you'll be surprised at how often you use them and how comforting an honest answer can be to a child.
Right. And, of course, when it comes to a student experiencing abuse or something really terrible, you don't make promises you can't keep, like this will never happen again or I'm going to fix this, but I'm here for you. I am your ally. All of those important promises are important to make. And, of course, you spend a lot of time talking about what it means to be an ally and how to explain that to a student. But let's finish out with a goodbye and the high five goodbye that you like to use on a typical day in your classroom. What is the high five goodbye?
Yeah, so that's just a little way that I kind of make sure that each kid has like a nice ending to their day, regardless of what happens. And I don't mean to suggest like my classroom is like a utopia where we don't experience challenges, because we do a lot. But like no matter what happens, I just want to send my kids off into the world with like feeling good about their classroom, feeling like they're welcome. And, you know, there's always a second chance. So, you know, I'll just invite kids sometimes to like, what are we going to say today as our goodbye? And they'll say like, let's say we are smart. And so as they're leaving, they all give me a high five and they all say like, we are smart or we are strong. And it's just like these small, simple things that teachers can do in their classroom that really add up and really impact kids when they're done together.
There's much more to enjoy and explore in this book called I Wish My Teacher Knew, How One Question Can Change Everything for Our Kids. And of course, you've written this book at a time when so many teachers feel under siege in so many ways. It's not an easy time to be a teacher. I wonder if you can just say a quick word about that reality as we finish.
Well, I would say I don't think there's ever been an easy time to be a teacher. You know, teachers, our job is very political in that all of the decisions that politics makes and all the policies like really affect us in very real ways. And oftentimes, you know, it's very easy to blame schools that aren't, you know, living up to our expectations on teachers. But I would say that really, if we are going to fix our education system, we need to really have an honest conversation about why kids are struggling in school. And, you know, most teachers I know are extremely committed, have a well-rounded professional practice, view themselves as professionals, and work very hard. But it is very difficult, you know, in a climate where, like I said, more than half of students live near or below the poverty line. So I think that as teachers, like, it is very a difficult time to be a teacher. But we can combat that by uniting together, by using our teacher voice to speak out about the truths we see every day in our classroom. And we can, I truly do have optimism about our school system. I do think that we can improve our education system and give every kid the excellent education that they deserve.
I Wish My Teacher Knew is published by DaCapo Lifelong Books. Kyle Schwartz, thank you so much for writing this wonderful book and for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Oh, thank you so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, UW Parkside English professor Jonathan Shaler will join me to talk about the current presidential campaign and the kind of rhetoric.